From the studios of KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jessica Sofer is my guest. Her debut novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, was just published to enormous acclaim, and I think it has gotten such a positive response because it's really good. Jessica Sofer has been published in Granta, The New York Times, and Vogue. Jessica Sofer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jessica Sofer, what puts the ape in apricot? No, congratulations on your novel and the grand reception it's receiving from the critics and a lot of readers on Amazon, too. Are all those Amazon readers from your immediate family? And if not, it must be super gratifying to see how much they love your book.
They're all my mother. I've banned my mother from writing an Amazon review, so fortunately none of them are my mother.
Well, it's great. How does it feel to see all those people reading your novel and talking?
It feels funny. It's such a weird moment. I don't think I was prepared for this moment to be as weird as it is. I think, you know, it's strange because one would imagine that this would be the moment that you prepare for and that you think about. But I think that in order to really feel like you can write the book you want to write, you sort of have to write with your head in the sand, because otherwise you're just answering a question, and really you don't want to be answering a question. You just want to be completely free. And so then you pick your head up and look around. It's like a very weird thing that people have these opinions, and I think it sort of never feels good enough. There's been a kind of sense that the book is very somber, which I never thought that it was, somber with no redemptive qualities. And I mean, it certainly has its down moments, but it's just been very strange. Opinions are strange.
Yes. Well, we're very thin-skinned, those of us who are in public, and I mean, I can't stand it. I don't like any kind of criticism at all.
Yeah. Even the good stuff feels funny. It never feels like the right thing, and not that it feels like the wrong thing, but it just never it's never enough. It's always...
They love my book, but they love it for the wrong reasons. Is that what you mean?
Which is not to say that I'm not completely but maybe it just has to do with not being able to hear it, not being able to absorb it in the way that is probably appropriate.
It's kind of a loss of control, or, you know, I mean, the book was yours for a long time, and now it's everybody's.
Completely, and I think also there's a kind of melancholy in all of this that I didn't really think about, which is that the thing that I always loved to do, which was write, all of a sudden has become my career, and there are all these sort of steps involved and issues that have come up that just were never part of that initial kind of love or lust or whatever that is when you fall in love with something so deeply and decide that it's what you want to dedicate your life to. You don't really think of it as being a career in the kind of traditional sense that means the business side of things.
Well, while we're talking about that, the book not only the book is available as an ebook, an audiobook, and then also as an added attraction, it's available as a book.
That's the added attraction.
But so how do you feel about there's an audiobook. It's like a really produced audiobook with two actresses who play the roles, the prominent role voices in your book. Have you listened to it, or how do you feel about it?
I've listened to portions of it. It's very hard to listen to one's own work. I mean, I can't listen to radio interviews. Like, it's very hard to listen to yourself. At least that's what I found. But it's so flattering. I mean, to really think about the fact that someone has thought about this book and decided the way that they want to read it, even the fact that somebody wants to read it, is just flattering. There's no other way to say it.
So it doesn't, it's odd to listen to because it's yours, but you don't have any problem with the interpretation or...
No, I think, I mean, if I were a better reader myself, maybe I would have a problem with interpretation, but I'm such a terrible reader in the performance sense, I think. I do such a poor job. So really anybody reading my book, I'm just blown away by.
Lots of people are reading it, including
me.
Yeah,
I mean, reading it out loud. Like, at every reading, you know, I did my launch last week was with Colin McCann, and I desperately wanted him to just read for me because he's such a compelling reader.
Uh-huh. So it's a skill now that you have to sort of develop.
Oh, yeah, it's totally a skill. There are all these skills that are required, and it's funny, like, I think it was probably always the case that certain things were required of writers, but now there's this kind of understanding that writers have to be these personalities as well, and it's very strange. I mean, in a lot of ways, we're very solitary people, and what we do is really isolating, and then we're expected to come out and like look coiffed and normal.
And what if you're not as funny as David Sedaris or something, and people are going to...
Well, exactly. That's the thing with tweeting, too. I mean, nobody's told me that I have to tweet, but I think it's probably a good thing, and people generally think it's a good thing. But, like, I'm not really that quirky funny. Like, Jon Stewart should be tweeting. David Sedaris should be tweeting. I don't know if I should be tweeting.
Okay. I agree. Everybody,
thank you.
Everybody shouldn't have to tweet. I have yet to tweet or actually even look at anybody's tweet.
And look at how well you're doing. Maybe that's the lesson.
We're talking with Jessica Sofer and her debut novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the journey that the book has taken to publication. So now that, now you have this whole public thing that's going on. But what was it, you know, how did it happen? Where was this book born?
The book was born. I went to Hunter for my MFA. I went just after I graduated from college. And my second year, I wrote this story called Pain, which was the staccato recounting of a woman's life of pain from the time that she's a young girl to the time that she's an adult. And the story didn't work for a number of reasons, I think in part because it was so somber and there was no relief from that. But I just found the character quite compelling and decided that when I wanted to write a novel, I really wanted her to be the thing that I took with me, and I did. And so Sunan, when I was sort of writing her, expanding on her, which was after I graduated from Hunter, I sort of stumbled on this image in my head of these two women cooking together in a kitchen, and one was a young girl, which was naturally Lorca, and the other was Victoria, who becomes the novel's other narrator. There are three narrators, actually, but they're the two females, the two main narrators. And Victoria is an 85-year-old Iraqi Jewish widow. She loses her husband pretty early on in the novel. And they're both sort of looking for specific things. In Lorca's case, she's looking for a recipe, and Victoria is looking for the daughter that she gave up for adoption many years before. And they're both sort of more generally looking for solace and friendship and companionship and a way out of their respective understandings of loneliness. And I guess that's really where it started. And then I just worked on it for probably about a year and a half, and then got an agent, which I was lucky to. I think it's a hard thing. And worked on it with the agent for quite some time.
Now, how does that work? You know,
I was sort of lucky with the agent process because as soon as I graduated from Hunter, or I guess it probably coincided with the exact moment that I graduated from Hunter, I had a very, very short story published in Granta. And it kind of got enough attention so that when I was ready to get to contact agents, I had already been in touch with them. So it was nice. I really lucked out in that sense in a way that I don't know if I've really lucked out since. So that's how it worked for me.
And so was there a lot of rewriting in Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots?
There was. For me, there was. I mean, I don't really know how to judge that, but it felt like a lot. It felt like the real structural overhaul, which I really did have to do a grand structural overhaul of the novel, happened, I guess, in part when I signed with my agent, but then certainly when I started working with my editor. And basically, the novel was kind of meandering in a lot of ways. Plotless, I guess, is the less positive way to put it. And so I had to make what happened on page 250 happen closer to page 80, which required a whole lot of cutting and pasting.
And so how did you feel about that? You know, did you feel like, wait a minute, this is my picture and I wanted to do it the way I want? Or you were anxious to see it published and therefore you took their advice? Or how did that go for you?
I think I really, you know, I'm not good at plot. I've had this conversation with people before. I'm not a good plotist. I don't have a great sense of forward momentum. I can talk about, you know, a chair for hours on end, for pages on end, but as soon as something has to happen to that chair, I become a bit paralyzed. And so I've always been aware of that and certainly was aware that that was what the novel suffered from. But I think at a certain point, I didn't know how to fix it, and I needed someone to tell me how. And when my editor came in with these ideas, I really felt like they were the right ones. And the nice thing about her, and she continues to be, she continues to just floor me with how talented, how brilliant she is, but she really led me to a place where I figured out how to do it myself. But you know, she couldn't do it for me. There's no way, there would be no way for her to cut 200 pages and replace them with different ones. But she kind of led me to the place where I needed to be. And I felt very much like supported and directed more than taught anything, which I think is the right thing.
Yeah. Well, and now you're a teacher also, right?
I am, yeah. I'm not teaching this semester, but I taught last semester at Connecticut College and will most likely be there, I hope to be there next fall as well. I taught fiction, and I went to Connecticut College, which is a really nice experience. I feel like I have a unique understanding of the students and their lives and, you know, the reason why they look the way they do on Fridays, which means, like, bleary-eyed and highly dehydrated. I know exactly where they were the night before. But it's also just a really, it's a beautiful campus, and the students are so smart, and it's lovely. I'm really lucky to be there.
So did this process of working with your editor inform your teaching?
I think so. I think all of it really has informed my teaching. Like, I've been surprised at how much I understand about fiction. I mean, equally so, I'm surprised at how little I know about fiction, but you know, I've spent a lot of time in workshops, and I've spent a lot of time in kind of making this my life. And so the people that I talk to, my dearest friends, we talk about writing all the time. And so there's a way in which this has become me. And so teaching feels in a lot of ways like an extension of that in a really nice way. Like it feels like having a conversation about the thing that I most care about with people that I care about.
Well, Jessica, so for both of the women in your story are Jewish and of Iraqi descent, and you are Jewish and of Iraqi descent also.
I am, yeah. My father was an Iraqi Jew who came to the U.S. roughly around the same time as Victoria and Joseph, who are the two characters who are Iraqi Jewish in the book, this, around the same time they do. Lorca, who's the novel's other narrator, is not of Iraqi Jewish descent, but she is Jewish, and she sort of has like the culinary experience that my own mother did. So there's the Iraqi Jewish culinary experience on one hand, and on the other hand, there's kind of the more New York Jew, upper West Side kind of experience, which has everything to do with like Barney Greengrass and Fina Shapiro and that sort of thing.
And so, you know, I think people might read this and say, well, this must be her.
Yeah, that's such a terrible question. I've banned that question from my when I teach a fiction class, it's never allowed to be asked. There's a way that kind of cheapens the work, I think. And it's really not autobiographical. I don't think I could have written what I did if it had been autobiographical, particularly the sections of Lorca with the self-harm. I was never a self-harmer. I've never cut myself, anything like that. So, I mean, of course, I only know what I know. I had to learn a lot for this novel. If I'd written something else entirely apart from myself, I imagine the response would have been that I'm not entitled to write that sort of thing. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. But it's certainly not autobiographical, though my father was an Iraqi Jew.
And there's a lot of having to do with food. In fact, I was reading one of the reviews of your book, and maybe it's in front of me, and it said something like, a wonderful addition to the fiction about food genre. And I didn't realize that that was a genre, that there was fiction about food as a genre. Did you?
Yeah, I think that I did, yeah. I mean, I guess I've read a fair share of it. I think the thing that I was concerned about a little bit while writing was that I didn't really want to contribute to the kind of traditional foodie fiction, which is, I don't even know if this is traditional foodie fiction, but it's my understanding of it, that is very sort of, the language is seductive and it feels very kind of heartwarming and positive. There's a way that food kind of is constantly like made positive in fiction, and that really wasn't my point. I think there's a way in which it can be equally heartbreaking and a reminder of sorrow, and that's kind of what I wanted to do. And there's a number of food books that I can think of that do that, that make something more complicated out of the issue of food.
Well, so aren't those novels in which there is food? I guess I'm just quibbling about the whole foodie novel genre, but I didn't realize there was. But even though I've read probably a lot of them, but I didn't know I was reading them. I thought I was just reading a novel. But although your book does make one hungry.
I guess I'm glad to hear it. I think, yeah, I am glad to hear it. for sure.
As a big part of the thing revolves around a recipe called...
What's it called? Yeah. It's called Mescouf.
Right, I didn't say it correctly then. But there's a lot of recipes and a lot of food, and that's fabulous. But you also mentioned this thing about self-harm, and since you brought it up, let's talk about that a little bit. Because I guess that's a kind of a controversial part of your book, and you know, I'm a teacher, and I've taught a lot of young people, middle school age, like one of the characters in your story. And I don't think I've encountered it too often, but I think I have encountered it once or twice. And it's this baffling thing that kids would cut themselves, you know, and it just seems so incredibly baffling. And yet you do a pretty remarkable job of letting us understand how it comes up in this person's life. Did you do some research, or where did you find this?
Yeah, I did quite a bit of research. As I said, I was never a cutter myself, but I think, you know, it doesn't seem like escapism to me. I think a lot of people understand self-harm to be this way of escaping the world, and for me it really seems like inhabiting one's feelings and the world in a much more meaningful way. I think if you can't feel the emotions that one should feel or one imagines that one should feel, it's just natural to do something that would make you feel more. And I think that that's always what reading has done for me. It's been a way to kind of arrive at a better place and to make the world feel more meaningful and more tangible, I guess, which is strange, to make the world more real than the world itself. And so I think that that's why Lorca cuts herself, is because she just needs to feel. And that seems like a very natural urge and not a particularly strange one, although I think there's such a stigma attached to cutting and a misunderstanding of it. It is tragic, and it is rampant, and it's really rampant, and it's not just a female-based addiction. It's cross-gendered, and it's so sad.
But you just said two things there. I mean, you just said it was sad, but at the same time, not that it was good, but that it was understandable.
It is understandable. Which is not to say that it's not sad. I mean, I think it is both those things. I think the saddest part, really, there are lots of sad parts of it, and there are lots of understandable parts. But to me, the saddest part is the scars that are left. That oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, people can grow out of this, one can do it for so many reasons. But a lot of times, people do grow out of it. But the scars, of course, you don't grow out of. Recently, I was somewhere and I saw a woman who had scars all up and down her arms, and it could have been nothing other than her being a cutter. And she, I don't know, of course, but she seemed like she was okay in life and that she had sort of moved on from her particular experience with pain. And that's a very hard thing. She'll never be able to get past that. I wonder about what will happen if one day her child asks her what those marks are, what that conversation would be like.
Is it pre-suicidal behavior, or...?
No, I would say almost never that's the case. It's interesting. There can be all reasons, a whole slew of reasons why people cut. I mean, it can be... you can often look at the body as a map to identify why someone's cutting. If they're cutting lower down on their arms, towards their wrists, it can be a sign that they're trying to get attention in some way. If one is cutting on the lower part of the abdomen or the upper part of the thighs, there can be maybe the experience with sexual abuse. But it's not typically pre-suicidal action.
Okay. And it's pretty fascinating. And it's very well done in Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. I'm not saying that the person who cuts does it well. I'm saying that you described it well.
Thank you.
In the book. And it really is it's a lovely book. You also, I guess you really get into, you really like to describe stuff, like you were saying about the chair.
Yeah.
And so maybe you describe things that are, you know, you describe them so realistically that maybe I didn't even want to hear about them. Smells and things.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's a way in which I've always felt that fiction does more than just reflect the world, but can sort of reconstitute it. Like, it builds a world that is bigger, more real, as I said before, than the world itself. And so all that description is really just an attempt, and probably an overzealous attempt on my part, to kind of reconstitute something, to make it more.
Like it's a hologram of some kind. Or it's
that's a nice way of putting it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's wonderful in the food part, because, of course, it's not good if you're dieting. I wouldn't recommend your book to people who are. But are you big on food? I mean, are you a chef?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call myself a chef, but I do love to cook. I do love to cook, and I was talking to someone earlier about this, that I think, in a way, every New Yorker has become a little bit of a foodie, I think. And I would consider myself a foodie just by virtue of living in New York. I think you get to taste so many things, and it's so easy to taste so many different cultures and flavors that one becomes a foodie just sort of by default by living here. But I've always had a particular awareness, I think, of eating. My father's mother in Baghdad was a healer and believed in sort of eating for one's overall well-being, to really sustain and to nurture the body. And my father really embraced that, and he ate things in a way that was mindful. And so I grew up with this kind of awareness of, you know, eating to warm the body or to cool it, eating with just an awareness, a greater awareness.
Have you been to Iraq, by the way?
No, and my father never went back after he left. He left in the late 1940s and went through Iran and ended up at a country club for diplomats, where he had a beautiful singing voice, and they gave him fake papers saying he was from Bahrain, which allowed him to come to the U.S. to Ellis Island, and he ended up at Brooklyn College. But he could never go back. He did go to Iran in recent-ish years, but I've never been to the Middle East.
Do you have a desire to go?
I do, of course I do. The sad thing, though, is that there are no Iraqi Jews left in Iraq. I mean, I think the number is something like 8. That's what they say. I don't know if there are any. But it's not what it once was. I mean, it's a Muslim country now. So I think my experience there would be so drastically different than his experience ever was, or even probably what he could imagine it would be like.
Yeah, probably. Your father was an artist also.
He was an artist. He was a monumental sculptor and painter. He did a lot of abstract work and had success at it. He was an awful businessman and didn't really believe in selling his art. And so that's been an interesting experience trying to sort that out in his kind of legacy. He passed away 3 years ago. But he was an artist, I think, in practice, but also very much in mind. He spent a lot of time sort of sitting and thinking. And I think that as a child was very kind of unnerving, and I couldn't quite wrap my head around it. But as an adult, and as I kind of geared myself to become, you know, a version of an artist, a writer, it made more and more sense to me and was really something I looked up to. And both my parents, I mean, my mother was a writer. She's a true crime writer, and she was the editor of a magazine for years, a kids magazine. She was a playwright. They both sort of organized their life around creativity and finding ways to fuel their creativity through a career, perhaps in something else, whatever could enable them to do their art. And I think that has meant everything to me and to the way that I understand the world.
So you feel like an artist in mind as well as in practice?
I don't know. That's such like now that you say it back to me, like when I think of myself as an artist, it seems sort of more lofty than what I am. I mean, I do write. That is what I do. But it's taken me a long time to say that, to identify myself as that, because it feels like, I guess in a lot of ways, it feels like a gift to be able to do that. It feels like something that one should have to work hard to do, and I guess that I have. But at the same time, it's so much what I love. I think it's weird to conflate the thing that one loves with what one actually does.
Well, I do have a hardcover book with a dust cover that has your name on it.
Okay.
So therefore,
that's
you
me then.
Did. Yeah. So, Jessica, so far, are you a person that has some stories rattle around in your head, and you've got some other novels that we're going to be enjoying for years to come, or is this?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, I haven't really sat down to start working on the next one yet. As of now, I'm still really excited to do so. I'm terribly afraid that as soon as I sit down, all of my ideas will vanish and I'll just slump into a fit of humility. But at the moment, I'm really excited to get started on something new.
But you don't. It's not there yet.
It sort of is in my head. I just unfortunately literally haven't had time to really sit down and start working on it yet. I've been working on a lot of nonfiction pieces and short stories.
I enjoyed your piece in The Opinionator in the New York Times recently.
Oh, thanks. There's another piece coming out in the Times this weekend, actually, for Mother's Day.
Fantastic.
That's
great.
Yeah, it's nice.
Well, congratulations on all your success. The book is called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. It's the first novel from Jessica Sofer, but not the last. And I hope that you'll come back and see us when your next novel comes.
I'd love to. It's been such a pleasure.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank Jessica Sofer for being my guest. Her debut novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. It's a good one. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.